Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 15th of June. Our guest this hour, Heather Hurlburt, directs the New America's New Models of Policy Change Project. Earlier, she ran the National Security Network, a premier source for international foreign policy messaging and advocacy, and she has held senior positions in the White House and State Department under President Bill Clinton, worked on Capitol Hill, and for the International Crisis Group. She writes about the story of the explosive 2016 primary season has been ideological rifts within, not between, the parties. That storyline will likely die down, she says, during this fall's election campaign, but it won't stay gone forever and will return with a vengeance in 2015. Does this foreshadow a time of partisan acrimony and policy failure even worse than what Congress has seen in recent years? Maybe not. A closer look gives us reason to believe that instead, better days for legislative accomplishments are around the corner, and elected officials, advocates, funders, and regular citizens can take steps now to help get them here faster. She will outline the kinds of issues on which there has been agreement, even though people come from different ideologies, and we will talk about where there has already been progress and where there might be more progress. The New Models of Policy Change Project in New America has been going on for 18 months, looking at case studies of what is called transpartisanship. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Heather during the course of this hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're on Twitter as well, and that's at K Dunn Show. Heather, hello. Thank you very much for being with us. Heather, are you there? Hello. Hello, Heather? Hello? Well, we got something wrong with our technical equipment here, so we will try and figure that out. The second hour of our program today, we are going to be talking more about the Orlando shootings. We will have two guests with us, a reporter from the Washington Post who has spent the week doing extensive reporting from Orlando, and he is there today. And we'll also be speaking with an internationally known scholar of lesbian history and literature, as well as ethnic history and literature. She's the author of several books. Her latest is The Gay Revolution, The Story of the Struggle. So that's what's on our lineup for today, a very full show, and we'll try once again to reach. Heather, are you there? Heather? I'm not sure. No? We should have. I don't know if there's something wrong here or what the problem is. So, at any rate, we welcome your thoughts. It has been such a partisan time. This whole idea of transpartisanship is an interesting one, and I thought I would start off with her as soon as we get everything figured out here. With what's going on in the Senate today, there is a Democratic filibuster right now where Democrats are trying to get Congress to act on gun control legislation. But what's happening behind the scenes is just as interesting. John Cornyn, the Senate's number two Republican, has told CNN that he is working with California Democrat Dianne Feinstein for a compromise proposal to address the issue of preventing those posing a terror threat from buying guns. So we will talk about that with her. And Cornyn said it's pretty clear Democrats aren't going to let us do anything until we deal with this issue. He didn't say when a deal could emerge, but is it possible we could see the first kind of deal on some kind of gun issue, first agreement that we've had in a long time. He said we're trying to see if we can find common ground. We both believe that terrorists shouldn't get guns. And there are other issues where there is transpartisanship, and we'll talk about that with Heather, and I think we're okay now. Heather, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Oh, I'm
thanks
so sorry. Yeah, thanks, Heather. We just got mixed up with our technology, but thank you ever so much for being with us. Let's start, if you don't mind, with an issue that seems to have been intractable for such a long period of time. I found it interesting, while the filibuster is going on the Senate floor, that John Cornyn and Dianne Feinstein are working feverishly, he says, to come to some kind of measure that would keep terrorists from getting guns. He said they both agree on that. Is this an issue of transpartisanship? Is it bipartisanship? What is it?
Well, I would put this in the sort of old-fashioned bipartisanship bucket, which is to say you have individuals who are leaders of their respective parties, Senator Feinstein for the Democrats and Senator Cornyn for the Republicans, recognizing that they have a common interest. They've got two different pieces of legislation, and they're going to come together and compromise to get something that certainly is not going to satisfy either side, but that gets you somewhere in the middle. And that's the path of policy progress that most Americans are familiar with, and that we think about how things get done. What's changed in this very ideological period that we're living in is that you've had other issues where, instead of the momentum coming from the center of both parties, you get people who are more on the edges of both parties finding places where they agree across party lines and then pushing in on the center of the parties to change. So I actually think in the long run, if you're going to have big movement on gun safety or some of the other hot button issues that you were listing off, it's going to take, just because we now have voters who say, hey, wait, I sent my representative to Congress explicitly not to compromise.
Right. And some of the issues you highlight where we have seen transpartisanship, I guess we forget about some of these. Certainly national reforms to the criminal justice system. You also talk about changes to how the U.S. conducts electronic surveillance, several years reforms to the Pentagon budget. Those have been the result of transpartisanship, which I guess we need to define more fully.
Yeah, so, you know, it's interesting. We do have this habit sort of in every part of life that we forget about the successes and we only think about the failures, because, of course, those are the things that we talk about. But again, so just to give a sort of helpful working definition, bipartisanship is, you're a Democrat, I'm a Republican, we get together and write a proposal that gives each of us 60% of what we want, and then we go back to our voters in Wisconsin and say, hey, I compromised to get you 60% of what I want. Transpartisanship is, you're a libertarian Republican and I'm a Bernie Sanders Democrat, and we get together and, to quote Grover Norquist, we think different people might be spying on our email. We're not worried about the same people looking at our email, but we both think there's a need for greater attention.
Oh, we lost the connection with Heather. Oh, hello?
Hello?
Yes, okay, we got you again. Go ahead.
Yeah. And then we go back to our voters and say, hey, look, I got 100% of what I wanted. It makes me a better liberal, or it makes me a better conservative to vote for this bill. So what we're doing is that we're not assuming that the best solutions come through the middle.
Mm-hmm. We're assuming, I guess the rest of that sentence is, we're assuming that the best ideas may come from those who have pretty strong ideological beliefs, but we can find agreement, even though the reasons for our agreement may be different. We're going to try and establish a better phone connection with Heather. We're just having some technical difficulties this hour. Our guest is Heather Hurlburt. We're talking about transpartisanship this hour. We've spent many shows, actually, talking about partisanship, but this is something that's different, and her organization has spent 18 months looking at transpartisanship and the kinds of areas where it seems to have worked. Drug sentencing has been one of them, criminal justice reforms. Could it work for other kinds of issues, and what might those issues be? That's what we are discussing this hour of the show. Eventually here we'll be welcoming your phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Sorry, Heather, we're back again. Yeah,
sure.
Yeah, we're just having technical difficulties galore. So if you have people, partisan forces on the right or on the left, and their ideological beliefs, are there many issues, though, considering the fact that what we believe pretty strongly, be we on the left or on the right, are there many issues where we can find some kind of agreement on issues that are incredibly divisive?
Well, I think this is the surprising thing, that there's actually a lot more issues than you'd think. And the challenge is not so much how divisive the issue is, but whether we can find another way of thinking about it. So I'll give you an example that I predict you're going to see a lot of in 2017, and that is climate change.
Yes, okay.
And that, you know, may come as a surprise because we think right now that... but in fact,
So we will talk more with Heather about climate change and that being an issue that we may see some kind of movement on, when indeed there hasn't been very much movement. So she'll tell us about that in just one moment as soon as we get her on yet another line. She says that the playbook here isn't easy to moving policy in 2017, but it is fairly straightforward. You start with a policy that can be framed as good for individual liberties and limited government. That would be good for the right. And empowerment and justice for the left. That would be good for the left. Cost-cutting or efficiency, a bonus for both sides. And then you find entrepreneurs who are trusted within their ideological home communities and willing to work outside them. So we will try on a different line now. Heather, hello.
Agreement around infrastructure.
I'm sorry, we'll have to go back. We lost you again for a moment. You'll have to go back to climate change, Heather, and why, even though we thought that this was an issue that we wouldn't be able to talk about in 2017, you thought that we might be talking about it. So pick up from there, please.
Yep, I think we will, because what you're going to see is that for political reasons, you're going to have more and more elected officials who want to be associated with doing something about climate. The way they're going to frame it is as having affordable and smart energy policy. So you're going to be able to say, I favor diversification of energy sources. I favor lessened reduction reliance on fossil fuels without, if you don't want, you're never going to have to say the words climate change. And we've seen this. The reason we know this is coming is that we've seen it around the country at the state level, where you have really interesting left-right coalitions for solar power, for breaking the monopoly of electric utilities, which is something dear to the hearts of the right, and making it easier to bring solar power into people's homes, dear to the hearts of progressives. So this brings up, actually, Kathleen, another point that I think is really important for your listeners. A lot of the way we talk about what's wrong with American politics seems to originate in Washington or on Wall Street or in places that you know, most Americans feel like they have no access to. But in this frame of what's right about American politics, most of the interesting things that are happening are very much happening at the local level and then being pushed into Washington rather than the other way around.
Mm-hmm. And why is that?
Couple reasons. First, that, you know, the American people are ingenious and creative and dislike gridlock and get, you know, instead of after however many hours of watching on the TV how bad everything is, people do tend to shut off the TV and go talk to their neighbors and try to find something constructive to do. You can't stop Americans from trying to fix things. But the other reason is that, unlike in the past, our political parties are actually in some ways weaker than they have been in recent years. And your average member of Congress feels a lot more dependent on donations, but also on the threat of a primary fight in his or her district. So we're looking to influential voices to tell us what is a safe thing to vote for and be a Republican. What is a safe thing to vote for and be a Democrat? And we get those signals from our districts and from our local fundraisers, as much as from the party headquarters and party committees where we got those signals in the past. So that's created an opening at the local level. And as I say, the good news is that Americans in a variety of red, blue, and purple states are running into that opening.
And those influential voices are important. Who are they?
So, you know, you have this funny situation if you're a Republican that you still face a limited number of very, very large donors. But as we've seen in this electoral cycle, those donors are deeply divided on really major issues. So Sheldon Adelson, the casino magnate from Nevada, has very different views on national security policy and, for example, how much surveillance is appropriate, how much use of the American military is appropriate, than do the Koch brothers. So basically, if you're a Republican, you can choose, and you can work both sides of that. If you're a Democrat, you're looking at the Bernie Sanders campaign model of, you know, thousands and thousands of small-dollar donors and small-dollar donors who kept giving and giving and giving, and you're saying to yourself, well, it looks like there might be more of an independent funding base from the establishment funders who have more traditionally been Democratic Party funders. So those are both, you know, it remains the case that money plays a very outsized role in our democracy, but mm-hmm. in an interesting way, that money has diversified in recent years.
You also, in the report that you wrote, talk about the importance of personal relationships still being the lubricant for any effective coalition. We still need to sit down and talk to each other. Are we doing that? Are we doing that on the state level more than the national level?
Well, it does turn out that we're doing it on the state level more than the national level. And, you know, frankly, the other sort of dirty little secret about politics is that people go into politics because they like rubbing elbows and working with other people. You know, not all, but a majority of politicians, and this is absolutely bipartisan, are extroverts who love working with people, making deals, figuring stuff out. So what I would say is you have on both sides of the aisle this pent-up force of human energy that wants to be talking and schmoozing and working and getting stuff done. And the very intense ideological controls that we've been experiencing have made it harder to do that, but people look for ways around it. The other thing that's happened in Washington, as opposed to state capitals, is that all our legislators go home on weekends and work very hard to convince everyone that they don't actually live here, which dramatically reduces the amount of time they have to interact with each other and build relationships of trust. And, of course, that doesn't happen at the state level where you all live in the same state all the time. At the staff level, too, it's really remarkable. You know, I had my first congressional job in the early 1990s, and there's been kind of a steady decline in how much people communicate with each other, how much people communicate across party, so that I recently spoke to someone who just left the Hill who commented that his best colleagues he knew only by email.
Really?
He could have been walking down the halls of the Capitol with his head stuck in his cell phone, and he could have bumped into someone who was one of his best contacts whose head also would have been stuck in his cell phone, and they wouldn't have recognized each other.
Hmm.
So a significant part of the problem is giving people space and opportunities to make relationships of trust.
Mm-hmm. Getting rid of some of the cell phones, perhaps. Putting them away for a while.
I fear that we're going in the opposite direction on that one.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. We're going to welcome phone calls for you, and we'll start taking them here in just a moment. Our guest this hour is Heather Hurlburt. She's director of the New Models of Policy Change Initiative at New America's Political Reform Program. And it's a different way of looking at how we make progress, how we can get legislation that's passed instead of this perpetual gridlock. It's called transpartisanship. New policy ideas are validated by partisan forces on the right or the left and then embraced at the grassroots roots as authentically left or right, and it's policy issues that both will find would be advantageous, maybe for different reasons, but advantageous, and so something is brought forward. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Lines are open for you right now, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. We'll be with you in a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, transpartisanship. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. And we go to Scott in La Crosse first. Hi, Scott.
Hi there, Kathleen.
Hi.
Shame on you. You stole my question while I was waiting on the phone.
I'm sorry.
I was going to ask the very same thing about the people coming home and not commingling. but having now fumbled for something else to ask about, I would like to know about, we hear about the attacks from, like, the conservative Republican being worried about attacks from the right, and from a Washington perspective, wouldn't these kind of pairings, if they got too commonly advertised, give a lot of fodder for that kind of thing? You know, I could just see, well, you know, it's kind of like Russ Feingold and Orrin Hatch. You know, you'd not want somebody on your side of the party, of your party challenger in a primary, coming up with pictures of two people like that together, saying, you know, these are best buddies working on this thing, these issues. Do you see what I mean? Isn't there that kind of a danger on the national level?
That is a great question, and I'm glad you brought that up. And thinking of Hatch Feingold in particular. So it used to be that Russ Feingold and Orrin Hatch could get away with that kind of thing because they could both come home and say, look, you know, I am bringing home policy progress for my state. I am bringing home specific benefits for my state, and that is what you all elected me to do. Back when we were not as well sorted ideologically as we are now. And, you know, many of us, I'm thinking of my Portage as I say this, many of us grew up, or our parents grew up, voting for one political party or the other because our parents and grandparents had voted that way, maybe not because of their specific positions on specific issues. And over the last 40 years, we have, as a society, very effectively sorted ourselves. There's a set of things that Republicans believe, and there's a set of things that Democrats believe, and they're different, as listeners know. So even compared to sort of the Feingold-Hatch moment, yes, there is much greater reluctance to be seen in public closely associated with a member of the other party, because you can always be accused of ideological impurities. And frankly, especially for House candidates, you can always be primaried. The district I live in Maryland, just had the most expensive race in the history of Congress, and it was a Democratic primary. One of the challengers spent money at a faster rate than Donald Trump.
Goodness.
So, you know, it's a non-trivial risk. Now, how you get around that, by the way, is again this business of, I'm not hanging out with Russ Feingold and compromising with him. You know, Russ Feingold is still a dirty liberal, quote unquote. But I have an issue, and you know, let's say it's what's going on the Senate floor today. You know, thinking about guns after Orlando. And you say, from a conservative perspective, I think terrorist suspects shouldn't be able to get guns. And Russ Feingold, from his perspective, thinks it should be harder for everybody to get guns. So we have we work together on a piece of legislation, and aren't I smart? Because I got that liberal Russ Feingold to support this thing, which is a core conservative value. And then Feingold goes home to his voters and says, aren't I smart? I got Orrin Hatch to sign on to gun control. I mean, hypothetically, if that were the... So the way that members of Congress are effectively inoculating themselves from the kind of primary challenge that you mentioned is, as Kathleen put it, when you work together on these kinds of policies, they have to come through an ideological lens. So you have to be able to say, I'm doing this because it's good liberal ideology or because it's good conservative ideology.
Hmm. Anything else, Scott?
Well, I sure hope this comes to fruition. If not, I think we got real trouble. I know we got real trouble, but I think it'll be even worse trouble. So I'll keep fingers crossed and rooting for this side for sure. Thanks, Kathleen. Great
Thanks,
program.
Scott. Nice to hear from you. Thanks. Let's go next to Peter in Baraboo. Hi, Peter.
Hi, Kathleen. Thank you so much. I just wanted to make a comment about working together across the aisle. I am an elected official. And I have a colleague who is 180 degrees opposite me in our ideological beliefs. And because we have had the time to share coffee, to share conversation, to discuss the challenges we have as parents, as members of a community, because we have gotten to know each other as human beings and create a level of mutual respect for each other, both my colleague and I have stood up and voted in the same manner, supporting each other in areas that we believe are important because they are human issues, not ideological issues. And we must elect people who are willing to focus on those areas rather than on the edges or the extremes. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Peter. Heather.
You know, yeah, two things. First of all, Peter, I have wonderful childhood memories of Baraboo.
Oh, you do?
Bring it back. I do. Like I said, my grandfather was one of nine farm kids from Portage, and the family visit every summer, we'd beg to make a side trip over there. So so that brings back fond memories. But Peter, your experience brings up a really important point, which can be very frustrating, is that we all want solutions to our problems now. You know, we want gun control advocates want gun control today, if not yesterday. You know, we want fixes to our crumbling roads and infrastructure last week already. We want college to be affordable by the time we go back to school this fall. And, you know, human relationships take time. Human relationships don't operate at the speed of the internet. And, you know, one of the real challenges we face is that, you know, you can get on Twitter and in 30 seconds you can tear down a relationship with someone, but it takes days and nights of the kind of trust building that Peter talked about to get to elected officials or to community leaders coming from very different places to realize that, well, we may continue to disagree on abortion. But, oh, look, we disagree. We do agree on this aspect of education, so let's work together on that and put the other thing aside. And that, you know, it's very countercultural in a way where we all kind of expect instant consumer service for everything.
What about, is this pertinent to the conversation, what's happened within parties? So we have a year of a Trump wing, a Ryan wing, and others in the Republican Party, a Clinton wing, a Sanders in the Democratic Party. Does that make transpartisanship more difficult? Does it mean that transpartisanship needs to extend within parties, or is it not relevant?
It's actually making it easier, because it's easier to buck your own party hierarchy if you have another power base to go to. So, you know, imagine that you're running for a congressional seat in Wisconsin this fall. If you're a Republican and get elected, you're going to be able to choose, you know, are you a Ryan Republican? Are you a Rand Paul Republican? Are you a Donald Trump Republican? If you're a Democrat, you're going to be able to choose, are you a Clinton Democrat? Are you a Sanders Democrat? And so then, you know, if you want to take a position that the other party disagrees with, or sorry, if you want to take a position across party lines, say, and you're a Sanders person, you know, you'll then be able to raise money from the Sanders base, even if the Clinton base says, no, we don't like that position. So actually, you know, having the way that we got the major pieces of social legislation that we got in the 60s, governmental reform that we got in the 70s, tax reform that we got in the 80s, the parties had not just party control, but also regional control. So, you know, if you wanted to pass a dairy bill, representatives from dairy states could work together. Now, it's gotten much harder. You're expected to support the party line over representatives from different parties but with similar state interests. So as we go through, and you're absolutely right to point to that, you know, we're going to see major realignments, if not outright breakup of at least one party in the coming years. And so frankly, it may be that the two parties are going to be incapable of doing anything at the leadership level, and this kind of policy change is going to be the only kind we have.
Well, that means that people need to step up, right?
It means that people need to step up. It means people need to step up at the federal level. And I have to say, I'm pleasantly surprised by what's happening today on gun safety, that I do think you're seeing faster movement away from what's been standing pattern for a long time than I would have expected. But the other piece of it is people at the state level need to make sure their national legislators know, hey, we've effectively solved this problem across the aisle in our state, and we want to see you do some of the same at the national level. And that's happened, by the way, that's happened with sentencing reform, where, you know, sentencing reform started in Texas, which people don't tend to think of a hotbed of progressive social policy.
I didn't know that.
In Texas, Republicans, actually it was within the Republican Party, there was a huge debate about whether sentencing laws were moral, but also were cost-effective.
Mm-hmm.
And then they connected with progressive groups and progressive religious groups who'd been advocating for changes for years. And once Texas had done it, then a lot of other states said, well, if conservative Texas did it, you can't say I'm not a conservative if I do it because Texas did it. You know, the death penalty. Nebraska repealed its death penalty last year. Now, there's a popular movement, interestingly, to roll that back, and there's going to be a vote in November of this year. But Nebraska, you know, possibly the reddest state in the country, had its legislature vote to repeal the death penalty, and it's going to have a popular vote on it. And you can't imagine that happening in the federal level. So really, really, the movement is happening at the state level, and the challenge is communicating to very politically wary federal legislators that these policy solutions are happening and are being accepted.
Another one, and there has been amazing left and right agreement on certain parts of education reform, Common Core, certainly school curricula. That's been interesting to observe.
Well, that's been interesting that you've had both left-right agreement on certain aspects and left-right opposition on certain aspects.
Mm-hmm.
So you had a very classic centrist coalition, you know, governors, Republican governors and Democratic governors and major foundations and corporate America really engaged in that. And over time, you had sort of separate right-wing and left-wing oppositions that didn't like each other well enough to actually work together. They didn't do what Peter described. You know, they didn't ever sit down and get together and say, hey, do teachers' unions and libertarians have a common view of American education? It sort of turns out they don't. But interestingly, they watched each other on social media. So that kind of coalition in a number of states has really pushed back on the Common Core reforms, but they haven't been able to come up with a productive alternative. You know, for that, again, it turns out the human element is necessary.
Our guest this hour is Heather Hulbert. She is Heather Hulbert is director of the New Models of Policy Change Initiative at New America's Political Reform Program. And we're talking about transpartisanship. We live in these really parties, individuals at each other times, great, great partisanship. But she says, and she's spent the last 18 months conducting case studies of transpartisanship, and looked at the key participants and looked at the outcomes, and says that the lessons that she's learned that should generate optimism as well as wake-up calls about how advocates and policy entrepreneurs in and out of Congress should do their work. What do you think about what she's been saying? And she's also highlighted certain issues on which there has been agreement, even though people have ideological differences that may be profound. There are areas of agreement that will allow us to do something on certain issues. She thinks climate change will be one that's coming up in 2017. We've already had changes in criminal justice reform, drug sentencing, opening monopolies to competition from solar producers, and although not very complete, changes or concerns about school curricula and testing. Here's our phone number. If you'd like to join the conversation, we'd love to hear from you. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. The Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Transpartisanship this hour, and our phone number again for you to join us is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Let's go and talk about some more issues where we might be able to see some kind of movement. I think people are thirsty, hungry, Americans are, for some kind of movement on the important issues of the day. They've had it with nothing happening in Congress, no movement, people not talking to each other, and very few pieces of legislation. We've talked about a few. What are your hopes for other areas where we could find some kind of movement, and what might it look like, Heather?
Well, one that has proven very difficult, but that I know Americans are really hungry for, is campaign finance reform.
Mm-hmm.
And a wonderful anecdote that illustrates both how hard this is and what the promise of it is that I met a student group at the University of Colorado that had formed to try to, at a student level, come up with transpartisan solutions to problems. And they picked an issue every year. And one year they picked campaign finance reform. And after several weeks of discussion, they decided that they weren't going to be able to come up with a solution, and they hoped if they worked the whole year, they would be able to get to an agreed definition of what speech is. So that, you know, again, to my point that this is hard, you know, sobering work that doesn't snap fingers and happen overnight. I mentioned the death penalty. And because that's one that, you know, I think we haven't seen as much at the national level, but, you know, the next red state that is rethinking its position on the death penalty is Oklahoma. And Oklahoma, of course, was in the news after a horribly botched execution a year or two ago. And that very red state is now holding a high-level commission and holding hearings, sort of statewide hearings to try to have some kind of change about both how it sentences people and how it actually executes people. And that came about with a combination, I mean, people across left and right who may or may not have the same views on whether capital punishment is an acceptable thing in itself, but who found around the idea that justice has to be administered consistently, fairly, and effectively. So that's a case where, you know, the most hot button of hot button issues, but by stepping away and reframing it a little differently, gave Oklahoma a path to move forward. So that, you know, that says to me that you can't count any issue out where you have people at the local level actually working hard on it. I think education is another one, because actually that bipartisan reform movement that we talked about before the break is perceived to have ground to a halt. And so folks in everything from Black Lives Matter to conservative activists are looking around and saying, okay, let's rethink this. What do we really have common ground on?
Mm-hmm. And going back to campaign finance, I've heard from so many legislators, and you would think that there would be just this widespread revulsion among almost everybody who's running for office that they have to spend so darn much time raising money and calling people and currying favors in order to run for office that everybody would say, we got to change this. There would be widespread agreement on that issue.
Well, you know, you're absolutely right. I have a colleague at New America who tracks this, and for a while, every single member of Congress who announced that he or she was not running for re-election in 2016 cited the burden of fundraising as a primary
cause.
Really? So you're absolutely right about that. However, If you are a sitting member of Congress, that means that you have made the system work for you. And thus, you are going to be extremely reluctant to reform something that you can make work for you. And when reforming it, it might become something that you couldn't make work for you anymore. So, you know, politics, it's not a terrible thing to say that politics runs on self-interest. It's just a human thing. So when you have members of Congress who are beholden to their donors and who are beholden to the party committees, it's going to be very, very hard for them to support policies like campaign finance reform that would weaken the party committees and would sort of diminish the amount of influence for their donors. So the challenge there is to build other forces of power that are stronger, so that instead of being afraid that their donors will walk away, their donors will disappear if they support campaign finance reform, to get to a point where there's a belief that voters would walk away if you didn't support campaign finance reform. And that, frankly, is, you know, campaign finance is such an abstract issue, and in a period where people are heavily focused on their own pocketbooks and what's going well and what's not, that's been a real challenge. The fact that it's been an issue on both the left and the right in the primaries should give us some hope that there's going to be room for a new look.
Let's go to Bob in Amherst Junction next. Hi, Bob.
Hi.
Hi.
You know, I think your guest is articulating such an effective way that bipartisanship and how governance can work, that it's common sense, and I wish we could do it in every case. But there have been so many cases, an example in Wisconsin, where one party is absolutely lying about their agenda. They have a hidden agenda. And then how do you apply any kind of collaborative methodology? Here's an example. When in Wisconsin, the Republican Party had decided to kind of join the National Republican Party mission to disenfranchise voters who are likely to vote for Democrats, they first said it was about voter fraud, but there wasn't any voter fraud. And then when they reduced the number of hours that early polling could happen, they did it in areas where voters were likely to vote for Democrats, but they lied and said it was because densely populated areas in the state shouldn't have any more open hours than sparsely populated rural areas of the state because of equality. And everybody knew that was just bogus because it's ridiculous. And everybody knows, in fact, there was testimony in a recent court case that the Republicans in the state of Wisconsin were very aware that they were doing it only to gain advantage in elections.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you get past the lies?
Heather.
So you raise a great point, which I would reframe as this method of cooperation doesn't change the essential nature of politics, which is adversarial and competitive. And any place where a party or a subset of a party thinks it can gain advantage, thinks it has identified adversarial tactics that will gain it advantage, it's going to keep doing that. And, you know, as long as, I mean, in your example, as long as the party is rewarded by its voters for those tactics, it's going to keep employing them. So I want to, you know, this isn't a panacea. I think the challenge that we face all the time and that our elected officials face all the time is, how far do you want to go cooperating on what you can, where you can, even as you perceive, as both parties, adherents of both parties do, and I have a clear partisan bias myself, but I am going to say that this is the sentiments you expressed about Republicans and lying, we could just as easily have a caller express them about Democrats and lying. I would disagree, but we have to sort of recognize that that's out there. That there are always going to be areas where you can cooperate and areas where you have to compete or struggle at the same time. And so, you know, the challenge for us as voters and for our elected officials is to pick out, you know, is it okay if we're working together on solar energy at the same time as we have this this dispute over voter rights, which to many of us is a very moral issue. Or, you know, to, again, to take an example coming from the other side, is it okay for Republicans to cooperate on sentencing reform at the same time as they feel they are engaged in moral struggles against Democrats? So, you know, politics is combative. It's never going to change. What this model suggests is that we can have those fights and we can scoop out little safe areas in which we can get good things done for the American people at the same time.
Thank you, Bob, very much for your call. Mary in New Lisbon sends an email. Instead of trying to forge these partnerships, why not encourage more candidates to run as independents? Wouldn't more get done?
That is another great question, which you've heard a lot of in our primaries this year. Particularly at the federal level, we have a two-party system that grossly discourages people running as independents. It's a lot harder to get elected. I mean, you aren't going to see an independent candidate for president this cycle, almost entirely because of how complex and expensive it is to get on the ballot in all 50 states and how early you had to do that. Now, it's not that hard to run as an independent down ballot, but you do lose major advantages. We are, however, going to see an interesting splintering of the parties, as I mentioned. And, you know, a lot of the agony that you see the Republican Party going through and that you see Paul Ryan in particular going through is because being one of the two parties in a two-party system comes with so many advantages. So to decide to strike out on your own is a really significant, you know, choice that is going to diminish your effectiveness both in getting elected and, frankly, as a legislator.
And let's go next to Dorothea in Hill Point. Hi, Dorothea.
Hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to say that I think a lot of the problem is on both sides, and I think it all kind of trickles down from Washington. It would be, I think, a very good idea if Congress and the Senate had term limits and weren't able to be like a lifelong career in Washington, because I think that breeds corruption.
Heather.
Yeah, there's a lot of debate over exactly those points, and there's actually interesting arguments that you can make that go both ways. So, for example, when you have members of Congress not talking to each other right now, they will say that they would like to talk to each other, but that they feel their voters are telling them not to talk to each other. So, as someone who sits a 10-minute walk from the Washington, Maryland line, the perspective here is that extreme partisanship has taken hold around the country, and that actually your most dedicated voters, you know, whether they're in Wisconsin or Maryland or Texas, are telling you, don't you dare talk to those other people. You know, term limits also is a challenge either way, because there's no question you don't want people to forget where they came from. At the same time, our legislative institutions are complicated, and there's a lot of evidence that people who stay around long enough to learn how they work are the people who are the most effective legislators for their states. And that, frankly, if you've got new people running for office every 2 years or every 6 years, then all they're ever doing is thinking about raising money. And you've always got a new person who's just pledged allegiance to a new bunch of donors to get in. So I'm afraid that neither of those is by itself the solution to our political problem.
Thanks, Dorothea, for your call. Heather, thank you so much. The report that you did, Can Transpartisan Coalitions Overcome Polarization? We will post that on our Facebook page, and people can get an even more in-depth look at the whole issue. Thank you so much.
It was wonderful to be with you all, and thanks for giving me a little credibility with my Wisconsin family.
Absolutely. Heather Hurlburt, director of the New Models of Policy Change Initiative at New America's Political Reform Program, talking about a phrase that maybe is new on the political scene, transpartisanship, a way to get something done in Washington, and maybe the model is what's been getting done in the local level. Thanks very much to KP Whaley for producing this hour and to Chris Molina for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. We have news coming up from National Public Radio. Hour two, we'll get the latest news from Orlando. We'll speak with a Washington Post reporter who's been covering the horrors from that part of the country for the entire week. And we'll speak with an internationally known scholar of lesbian history. So stay with us for hour two.